Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge today. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The April unemployment report came out today. 500,000 jobs were lost last month. Less bad than before, yes, but still lousy. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Monsanto, committed to sustainable agriculture, creating hybrid and biotech seeds designed to increase crop yields and conserve natural resources. ProduceMoreConserveMore.com. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you with us on this Friday. It is the 8th of May today. And the actual number was 539,000. That's how many people lost their jobs last month. The way things have been going, not as bad as a lot of experts had been guessing. And this morning's report does give some credibility to the, hey, things are turning around, school of economic thought. But the unemployment rate, the number of people out there actually looking for work, shot up to 8.9%. That's the highest that number's been since Ronald Reagan's first term. The current occupant of the Oval Office pointed out that at least the rate of job loss is slowing. But Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports that 500,000 layoffs in 1 month is still a whole lot of people.
For President Barack Obama, fewer layoffs mean the economic gears are slowly beginning to turn. But Econoplay forecaster Gary Rosenberger, who gathers his own statistics by talking to employers on the front lines of the economy, sees evidence of a different sort.
They're telling us this is not a sign of a turnaround. This is a sign that layoffs have gotten to the point where employers are laying off workers who are really valuable. These are the hardest workers to get rid of.
Which is why the pace of layoffs has slowed. John Challenger at the outplacement firm Challenger Gray and Christmas says companies are doing all they can to avoid letting workers go.
4-day work weeks, salary freezes. In fact, we're seeing some companies cut their wages 10 to 15%.
Because they want to be ready when the rebound occurs.
If the people aren't there, they may not have the operations to provide the quality product or service they need. So companies have to be very careful here not to overshoot the mark.
To take better advantage of furloughed workers, Obama called for allowing them to collect unemployment benefits while going to school or taking part in retraining programs.
The idea here is to fundamentally change our approach to unemployment in this country so that it's no longer just a time to look for a new job, but is also a time to prepare yourself for a better job.
The president announced a new website with education resources for the unemployed at opportunity.gov. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
GM announced this afternoon that CEO Fritz Henderson is going to meet with reporters on Monday morning. He'll talk about the carmaker's ongoing restructuring, probably be asked about more job cuts there, too. Production cuts that Detroit has been making for the past couple of years are working their way through the global economy. This has been a tough week for the steel industry in particular. Today, the German steel giant ThyssenKrupp said it's going to cut as many as 2,000 jobs in the next 2 years. And yesterday, the American steel industry announced almost 5,000 layoffs, including 1,700 positions at a U.S. steel mill in Alabama. From WBHM in Birmingham, Tanya Ott reports.
U.S. Steel says it's temporarily shutting down part of its mill in Fairfield, Alabama, on the western edge of Birmingham. The mill employs 1,700 workers. The company isn't saying how many will be let go or how long the plant will be idled. And that frustrates Mark Bentley, who's been cutting steel pipe here for 6 years.
If they could sit and tell us we're going to shut down for 2 months, people could deal with that a lot better. But for them to say, you know, we don't know. Well, somebody knows.
Bentley says workers don't know what they should do, whether they should get other temporary jobs or perhaps leave the steel industry completely.
We've been told everything from the beginning from a boss that the second half of the year orders are great. Are they telling the truth? Are they lying?
U.S. Steel has already idled mills in Michigan, Missouri, Minnesota, and Canada. Peter Morisi is an economist and steel industry expert at the University of Maryland. He predicts demand for steel will rebound with the economic recovery, but
unless we get a rapid expansion, and unless we do something about all the import competition in places like automobiles and construction steel and so forth, it's going to be more and more difficult for American mills to maintain their market share.
Morisi expects President Obama to address the trade issue next year, including the thorny problem of how China handles its currency. Critics say it artificially manipulates currency to keep exports cheap, and Morisi says that's been one of the biggest threats to the U.S. steel industry. In Birmingham, Alabama, I'm Tanya Ott for Marketplace.
With recessions come companies that promise to help individuals get themselves out of financial trouble. For a fee, of course. The debt settlement industry, as it's known, has grown from about 300 companies to 1,000 in just the past couple of years. Those fees and some other troubling practices have caught the attention of New York State Attorney General Andrew Cuomo. He's launched an investigation into 14 companies, calling debt settlement a rogue industry. From New York, Ashley Milne-Tite reports.
Cuomo says some firms have pressed clients to sell their blood plasma to pay off their debt and the firm's fees. Gail Cunningham of the National Foundation for Credit Counseling says there's not much to stop them.
It's a wild, wild west out there when it comes to regulation.
She says many debt settlement companies aren't honest about what they can and can't achieve for the client, and they charge a lot up front.
You know, let's have a fee once a service has been provided, and let's have that fee commensurate with the service.
Robbie Birnbaum represents the Association of Settlement Companies, an industry trade group. He says most firms have perfectly reasonable fees.
And I'll tell you, frankly, in the majority of cases, these companies are getting dramatic results for these consumers.
Like clearing 20 to 50% of their original debt. Birnbaum says the Attorney General should be looking at what he says are the real culprits, rapacious credit card companies. In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, nothing not to like about a less bad jobs report. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There may well be the temptation to drown your sorrows as the recession drags on, but fewer of us are actually doing so. Diageo, the world's biggest producer and distributor of alcoholic beverages, said this week sales are down 7%. In the long run, though, the whiskey business, at least, is looking pretty good because of soaring sales in emerging markets. So when a whiskey industry roadshow rolled into Shanghai, China today, Marketplace's Scott Tong was there.
Their show is called Whiskey Live, which seems fitting because an industry that was shrinking back in the 90s has roared back to life thanks to new markets like China. Sales here rose almost 500% in 5 years. So whiskey makers come here to keep evangelizing, explaining the basics of whiskey. Andrew Shand is with Speyside Distilleries.
The first thing would be that just the huge variety of different flavors in whiskey.
And there are a lot. Fellow Scotsman Ewan Shand is pouring and explaining two booths down at Duncan Taylor Distilleries.
There's a little bit of lemon, there's a little bit of smokiness, peatiness. If you go to a lowland whiskey, it's very floral.
Scotland is a long way from China, but consumption in Asia has triggered a global whiskey shortage. Here, the centuries-old British spirit isn't considered frumpy or out of date. In fact, it's a mark of success. Listen to 20-something Rain Lin.
If you look at the whiskey labels, you know it has tradition and history. You drink it, and you feel like a gentleman.
Okay, so here's the catch. Lots of Chinese drinkers mix their whiskey with sweetened green tea. Shanghai native Neil Lee explains why.
If we drink straight alcohol, we won't last very long. But if we mix something in, we can go longer, and we're happier.
Sometimes he mixes in Coke, or OJ, or Gatorade. Naturally, not everyone's a fan. Distiller Ewan Shan doesn't like it. But if a billion Chinese do, then this green tea concoction is their gateway drug, their whiskey training wheels.
Whiskey is like learning to ride a bike. Start off with green tea, dilute, then move into malts until you're practically drinking them straight.
In fact, Sean's about to introduce in China a pre-bottled mixture of tea plus whiskey, holding his nose with one hand, counting his cash with the other. In Shanghai, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
This was a week that had banks written all over it. Every day there was another leak about the Treasury Department's stress tests. This bank is going to need so many billion dollars more, this one won't. And yet, when all was said and done yesterday and the official results were announced, the reaction really was kind of a yawner. No market crisis, no imminent talk of banks going under. So that's where we're going to start our weekly wrap of Wall Street and beyond. We've got John Carney from ClusterStock.com with us and Heidi Moore of The Wall Street Journal. Hello again, guys.
Hi, Kai.
Glad to be here.
I want to talk about those stress tests because, you know, we haven't all talked about them enough. And Heidi, let's start with you. And my thesis is this, that maybe all the naysayers and all the, oh, these things are never going to work and it's just a waste of time, that was all wrong. And maybe we actually got something constructive and positive out of this.
Well, if we did, you'll have to tell the banks because they're in denial. So they are grumbling about everything that's happened with the stress tests. I mean, you'll see sort of like little areas of conscientious objection. I mean, Morgan Stanley put out a release today. They raised money to help meet their capital requirements. And they said that they were raising money because they were doing a joint venture with Smith Barney, and it was consistent with their long-term capital plan. So we're supposed to believe that this whole stress test thing is just a huge coincidence.
But wait a second, because there were predictions of like Armageddon here, right? That we would find out how bad these banks really were, and that didn't happen.
Right. But that doesn't mean that that's the truth, because a lot of people actually feel that the banks got off very easy.
John, what do you think?
I think that's exactly right. The public statements coming out of the banks that they think the stress tests were too aggressive, that they don't think their losses will be anywhere near as high as the government has estimated, completely conflicts with what you'll hear privately from bankers who have been referring to this as the feather test rather than the stress test. In other words, that it barely weighed on them at all and really didn't look at what the realistic losses levels will be.
Does this mean, Heidi, that the bankers believe in some way that they've gotten away with something?
I think the best way to understand what happens between the banks and Washington is sort of kabuki theater, right? So everyone knows their roles and they just sort of go through the motions of, you know, objection and resistance and cooperation as necessary throughout the election cycles. So I think that, you know, they're just kind of going through the motions so as not to anger Washington anymore.
John, let me ask you about that cooperation with Washington. There were all of last week and in the period of time leading up to the results, really serious leaks of this information. We had, you know, almost down to the tens of millions of dollars, how much money these banks were going to have to raise. If this had been a private company, you know, the CEO would be in jail. Was it a good thing that these leaks happened? And if not, why not?
I think from a PR perspective, it was a good thing. It prepared the market for exactly what was happening. I think, though, from a fundamental point of can investors trust what's happening in the markets, it was a terrible thing. If you were an ordinary investor, you didn't stand a chance. And the troubling thing is, it seems to me that this was done with government sanction.
Heidi, what's next with the banks then? Once we put this whole stress test thing behind us and Wells Fargo, as it did today, goes out and raises another however many billions of dollars and satisfies the capital requirements, what's the next big thing to look for?
Well, what we have is what everyone was afraid of, right? Which is that there is now a clear delineation between the banks that are going to be successful and the banks that are going to have to wrestle with TARP and with government interference. So you have Goldman Sachs and JP Morgan as your new banking overlords, basically. They don't have to raise money. They're free to pursue their business models, and they're going to be more competitive and use their competitive spirit as a way to take business from the other banks. Meanwhile, you have the other banks, and they look like the slow kids.
Very quickly, John, let me get your take on this morning's unemployment numbers. Is this a case of it's getting less bad, or is it a case of we're still doomed?
It's getting bad more slowly, which is a good thing. Right. It was good news to see the unemployment numbers today not keep accelerating at the level they were.
Heidi, the jobs report, good, bad, or somewhere in the middle?
I think it's great. I mean, if you talk to business leaders, you're finally hearing some optimism from them. They're talking about a real recovery. You're seeing the capital markets open again. I mean, at least there's some optimism in the air rather than the just sort of exhaustion and adrenaline that was fueling the past 2.5 years.
Heidi Moore at The Wall Street Journal, John Carney from ClusterStock.com. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, cash from composting.
When you go to somebody and you tell them you can cut their garbage bill in half, you're going to get their attention.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials rose 164 points today, 1 9/10%, closed at 8,574. The NASDAQ gained 22 points, 1 1/3%, settled at 1739. The S&P 500 rebounded 21 points, 2 4/10%, wrapped up at 929. For the week that was, the Dow climbed 4.4%. The NASDAQ gained 1.2%. The S&P 500 added 5.9%. Bank stocks rose today. Citigroup cashed in on 5.5%. J.P. Morgan Chase deposited 10.5%. Wells Fargo bounced up 13.8%. Fifth Third Bancorp, that's Ohio's biggest bank, flew up 58%. Go figure that one out. Bond prices rose, sending the yield on the 10-year T-note down to 3.28%. You're listening to Marketplace.
American Public Media presents the Poetry Radio Project. You can hear conversations with poets about the economy, music, cooking, and more at americanpublicmedia.org/poetry. Let us do the work for you. Download Marketplace's After the Bell, a podcast which makes sense of a week's worth of business news. Just go to marketplace.org and click on the podcast link.
On the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. World Ocean Conference 2009 convenes in Indonesia. Climate change is the focus. A mission gets underway to improve Earthlings' view into the universe. Space Shuttle Atlantis launches on Monday, carrying a crew of seven to make repairs and upgrades to the Hubble Space Telescope. And mind your manners, it's National Etiquette Week. Please and thank you. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Mother's Day is Sunday, but in the nation's capital, there is going to be another rite of spring this weekend, the White House Correspondents' Dinner Saturday night. Never mind that the economy is still sour, and the newspaper industry in particular is in free fall. This year's dinner is going to be bigger than ever, and as Marketplace's Steve Henn reports from Washington, it's a chance to do a little business, too.
Bob Garfield writes a column for Ad Age and hosts NPR's On the Media, and he's a huge fan of the White House Correspondents' Dinner.
It's really one of the most grotesque spectacles in the Washington calendar.
Okay, so he's not a fan.
Look, it's a social event that is all about showing off who you know and having that, you know, one night in your year where you're not just some sort of, you know, Washington journal wonk.
And it's not just the dinner. Major media companies compete to throw lavish after parties and for the most over-the-top guest lists. Entertainers like Ludacris, Ben Affleck, and the entire cast of Gossip Girl mingle with wonks and power brokers. Getting in is a big deal.
You know, it's like tickets to a Yankees game.
During the playoffs, Steve Scully sits on the board of the White House Correspondents Association. He says a ticket can be a great way to thank advertisers you really don't want to lose, especially now.
So news organizations have to make the judgment call, who does it benefit for me to invite?
Newsweek invited the CEO of AstraZeneca. He dropped $7 million on ads in the magazine last year. But tomorrow night, he'll not only get the chance to mingle with celebrities like Natalie Portman, he'll also get an opportunity to bend the ear of cabinet secretaries like Tim Geithner and Attorney General Eric Holder. And in Washington, that kind of access is priceless. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Had you been wondering what's going to power cars in a post-oil world, you can go ahead and cross hydrogen right off that list. Earlier this week, the Department of Energy pulled the plug on hydrogen fuel cell research. Ethanol is another contender for top alternative auto fuel. But a study in yesterday's Science magazine says despite the billions in government subsidies that ethanol fuel gets, it's really not all that efficient. Which leaves us with number three on the list, electricity. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Jennifer Collins reports.
Before we can pick a car of the future, we have to figure out how we're going to distribute its fuel. Tesla Motors is hoping it's picked a winner with electric cars. Dermot O'Connell is a vice president with the company. He says the electric grid is far closer to being able to power cars now. Any other type of fuel would need a new distribution system.
Something like a 50% conversion tomorrow into electric, pure electrics, or plug-in hybrids would not unduly burden the current electrical grid.
But experts say it also matters how you produce that electricity. An electric car's not all that green if it's getting its power from coal-fired plants. There are other issues, too. Electric cars are expensive and often have a limited driving range. But O'Connell says they'll soon have a less expensive sedan on the market.
The Model S, after the federal tax credit, will price at $49,900.
David Friedman at the Union of Concerned Scientists says don't go out and buy a Tesla just yet. He's cautious about picking a winning fuel now.
Anyone who tells you that the answer is plug-ins or battery electric vehicles or fuel cell vehicles or biofuels probably is trying to sell you one of them.
Friedman says he hopes the government will fund research for several kinds of cars and distribution systems. Then he says we should let consumers choose the cheapest, cleanest, and most fuel-efficient way of getting around town. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
I don't know how it works for you, but at my house anyway, it's the blue garbage can for recycling, the green one for yard trimmings, and the brown one for trash. Nothing, though, for leftover food, unless you've got a composting heap in your backyard. You throw scraps right in with the regular trash, no? Well, not so in San Francisco. The city wants to boost its already high recycling rate by making composting mandatory. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Caitlin Carroll explains.
The Boulevard Restaurant in San Francisco is packed on a Wednesday night. In the kitchen, cooks are juggling pans, grilling fish, and stirring sauces.
So here's the main line where all the cooking is done.
Executive chef Pamela Mazzola surveys the kitchen as plates of artfully arranged halibut and roasted potatoes make their way to the dining room. When the plates come back,
here, the waiters come, scrape off the plates. So all table scraps are composted.
Thousands of restaurants, apartments, and homes participate in San Francisco's compost program. That's about 70% of all San Francisco residents. The city has one of the best recycling rates in the nation, but it's not good enough for Mayor Gavin Newsom. He's pushing a law to make San Francisco the first city to require recycling and composting. He wants to push the recycling rate to 75% or beyond. It's not as easy as it sounds. To get the program started, San Francisco had to work out a system with a company that picks up the city's trash. It's called Recology. Recology's CEO, Mike San Giacomo, points out the waste industry is built on disposing trash, not repurposing it.
Collect it, put it in the ground, and that's really where the bulk of the industry made its money.
Now Recology has figured out a way to turn food trash into cash. It sells the compost to vineyards and farms. They're willing to pay $500 a truckload for the compost because it's packed with nutrients. To get an idea of what a change the compost plan has made to the city's garbage haul, all you have to do is visit the local 44-acre dump. I put on my galoshes, hold my nose, and waste manager Sean Davison leads the way.
So we're heading into the Organics Annex?
The Organics Annex, where all of San Francisco's food scraps end up after they're collected.
Thousands of birds feast on piles of rotting food.
You don't have a fear of birds, do you?
I don't.
They don't attack.
All this used to end up in landfills. Now the fish heads and rinds take on a second life as compost. Davison says people like the environmental payoff, but they like something else more.
We would like to think that it's the right thing to do, but most of it is financial. When you go to somebody and you tell them you can cut their garbage bill in half, you're going to get their attention.
Businesses who recycle can cut their trash bills in half. The garbage companies also make more if they meet recycling goals. San Francisco residents don't get a break on their monthly $25 bill for trash pickup. But if they don't compost and recycle, they could get hit with a fine of $100. Businesses could pay more. Recology doesn't want to play trash cop, so it's sending out compost and recycling starter kits. Apartment manager Linda Corso has hers.
And we put the posters that we got up over here so when people come down, they can sort of look at it.
She likes the compost plan, but worries that she could be punished if her tenants don't cooperate.
I can't go in and force someone to compost rather than put things in the trash, and I certainly can't sit and go through every bag of trash that gets dumped.
Success will come down to making renters care. Take Michael Kellenbach. He's interested. He just doesn't know what to do.
I'd want to know what to put in there. I mean, do you just put leaves?
Yep.
Do you put dead flowers?
Sure.
Do you put coffee grounds?
Yeah, those too. Plus ice cream cartons, cardboard boxes, and any leftover food you find. Other cities are watching San Francisco as the composting plan makes its way through the city government. If it becomes law, composting could become a household habit. In San Francisco, I'm Caitlin Carroll for Marketplace.
Caitlin somehow managed to take some pictures while she was dodging all those birds out at the dump. Go to our website to see them. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge today. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note, today we spend most of our time on this broadcast on the bigger economic stories. Most of our time, that is, except for a minute and a half every other Friday, when Rico Galliano and Brendan Noonan interview the Marketplace staff about the other stuff. You know, the news you might talk about at a dinner party.
Phyllis Owens, commentary editor of Marketplace. What are you going to be talking about this weekend?
Well, apparently in the UK, the recession has an upside. There's been a surge, apparently, in the number of people reporting criminals to claim rewards from this charity called Crime Stoppers.
So what you're saying is now that people don't have money, they're turning people in for money.
Right.
That means that when times were good, people weren't turning people in.
Well, maybe they held back just a little.
So before, it didn't bother me that you were a serial killer, but $35 is $35.
George Judson, managing editor. What are you going to be talking about this weekend?
Well, in most parts of the country, when a house is foreclosed on, you can tell because their lawn is a foot high and weeds. And in California, where we are, the lawn dies. So one town here has figured out, let's paint those lawns.
With actual paint?
It's some kind of biodegradable paint-like thing.
Don't you wish you could paint over all of your problems? You just wake up in the morning and paint your bed made?
I would like to paint myself awake in the morning.
I want to paint my 401k valuable.
Stacey Vanek-Smith, senior reporter at Marketplace. What story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
Well, reading is getting really expensive. This week, the New York Times announced that it's raising its price again, 33%. And Amazon just unveiled its new Kindle, big screen Kindle reader, which is sort of like an iPod for books. It's almost $500.
This actually doesn't surprise me. I ruined my credit reading Anna Karenina, actually. I think we should buy futures in haiku.
That is just a taste of what Brendan and Rico can do. Their podcast is called The Dinner Party Download. There's a link on our website. It's marketplace.org. And for this Friday afternoon, that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow rose 164 points, 1.9%. The NASDAQ added 22 points, 1.3%. The S&P 500 bumped up 21 points, 2.4% there. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste West, and the executive producer of the program is JJ Yore. Coming up on Monday, our poetry series wraps up with the work of Elizabeth Bishop.
The art of losing isn't hard to master. So many things seem filled with the intent to be lost that their loss is no disaster.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have yourself a great weekend, everybody.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.